You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to archpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to archpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's archpodnet.com/members.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 21. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we're going to be interviewing Dr. Shara Bailey about recently discovered hominin fossils in Morocco.
Let's dig a little deeper.
Good morning and welcome, or afternoon, evening, depending on when you're listening to this. We're recording in the morning. So, and welcome to the Archaeology Show. Today, we have a really interesting interview with Shara Bailey. She's an associate professor with the Department of Anthropology at New York University. And she's also a paleoanthropologist who specializes in dental anthropology. Part of the reason we're interviewing her today is because she's been working on a number of projects using dental remains from Neanderthals and other early modern humans to help clarify some ideas about human evolution. So we're going to get to talk about that today. All right. Welcome to the show, Shara.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're really excited about the chance to talk to you, in part because you've been in the news a little bit lately and doing some other interviews with some finds that you've been involved in. So to start out, for those of our listeners who, you know, may not have any anthropological background, can you tell us a little bit about what exactly paleoanthropology is?
Oh, sure. Paleoanthropology is the study of humans and their fossil relatives. And those relatives could be ancestors, or they might be what we think of as cousins, which may not have had anything to do with our evolution. So we paleoanthropologists study the bones and dental remains of these fossil relatives.
So I was just talking to somebody the other day about paleoanthropology. Oddly enough, somebody who doesn't really know much about it isn't in this business, and he was saying, you know, so he told me, he's like, so you're an archaeologist, and this is paleoanthropology, and you study humans still. Why don't you call that just archaeology? Maybe some people are thinking that. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, let me go back and restate what paleoanthropology is, okay?
Okay.
Paleoanthropology is the study of fossil humans and their relatives, which may or may not be ancestors of our species, Homo sapiens. It is also the study of the cultural remains that those fossil relatives left behind. So both biological anthropology and archaeology are involved in the broader study of paleoanthropology. But one thing we do not do is study dinosaurs, which is always the question I get when I say I'm a paleoanthropologist.
I think if you do anything in anthropology or archaeology, you get asked about rocks and dinosaurs. So
yes, absolutely.
I mean, I literally got asked about that just the other day by an older woman who heard I was an archaeologist, and she's like, "Oh, what do you think about Sue?"
Yeah, right, exactly.
And it took me a second.
I
was like,
"I love dinosaurs."
Sue. Oh, that's Sue. Yeah, 65 million years old. Too old. Yeah. All right. Well, to get a little more specific, as April said in the introduction, you study teeth. Why? What can we learn about teeth?
Well, really, the question is, what can't we learn from teeth? The teeth, first of all, I'll start off by saying that the teeth preserve better than any other part of your body, which is one of the reasons why they are so important for studying not only human evolution, but evolution of mammals in general, because most of what is preserved actually is the teeth. So teeth, the reason why is because teeth are about 97% mineral in content, which means they don't have to fossilize. They're basically already fossils in your mouth. And so whereas bone has a much greater organic component, and in order for bone to fossilize, minerals have to seep in from the environment and replace that organic material mm-hmm. with minerals. So that's why teeth preserve so well, and they're so well represented in the fossil record. And we use teeth to do all sorts of things. We can use teeth to tell us something about what an organism is evolved to eat. We can use teeth to find out what an organism actually did eat, because those two things are not always the same. Peter Unger just wrote a fantastic book that discusses the dietary signature in our teeth and why sometimes the bumps and grooves, the morphology on the tooth, give us a different signal than what the small wear pattern, the striations on the enamel of the tooth tell us about what an animal actually did eat. So we can tell something about diet. We can tell about function from the teeth. We can use teeth to tell us about relationships among both living humans and apply the same methods to humans in the past. So I have used the bumps and grooves, again, the dental morphology of Neanderthals and early modern humans to provide some, shed some light on their relationship. And the dental anthropology of Neanderthals has supported the genetic evidence that suggests that Neanderthals were a different species, or at least that Neanderthals and modern humans were evolving separately for a very long time. So the other really nice thing about teeth is that they, when you can't extract DNA, so there are, you know, going back more than, let's say, 400,000 years, people have not yet extracted DNA from human fossil relatives. But the morphology and the size and shape of your teeth is strongly is influenced by your underlying genotype. So in lieu of having DNA, we can tell a lot about relationships just based on the shape and form of the teeth.
Wow, that's pretty cool. I know that the mineral composition of teeth has been really important, but I know the shape as far as typing specimens and things like that has been used. And I guess I didn't really think about like use wear, which leads me to a side question. How much with all our dental work in the last, 50 to 100 years and all our teeth brushing, how much is that going to confound later dental anthropologists in several thousand years when they're looking at us today? Because we're cleaning our teeth so much.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. In terms of Western societies who are brushing their teeth, because of course not everybody, has access to, Crest and Colgate and toothbrushes. But in terms of Western society, all that brushing is totally confounding our wear pattern. Although I have to say, when I think about it, there was a very interesting study done by a colleague of mine. And so get this, he did casts of his teeth and he looked at the microwear on his teeth. And then he spent some time, maybe it was a week or so, eating stone ground corn muffins. So muffins that were made with corn ground by stone. And the act of eating those muffins changed the microwear on his teeth. So, some aspects of the diet probably would still be recorded, even if we are brushing away a lot of the dietary signal. But the one thing that we would be missing, at least for those of us who go to the dentist every 6 months and have the tartar taken off our teeth, is most recent work, I think it's this year or perhaps it was late last year, has shown that they can actually extract DNA of the things that we ate from the dental tartar or from the calculus, from fossilized calculus. So it's incredibly fascinating. And from that, and also from the plant remains, phytoliths that also remain in your dental calculus, they were able to show that Neanderthals who were top-level carnivores were also eating their veggies.
That's pretty amazing. So because our diet has changed so much, Chris's question kind of led me to this, how how quickly does the morphology of human teeth change over time? You know, are our teeth already starting to look a little bit different in how they function and are shaped than, you know, our ancestors 300 years ago?
Well, that's an interesting question. Of course, when you say how much have they changed, my mind goes back to millions of years ago. And, you know, you're thinking 300 years ago probably hasn't changed very much. So one of the big changes we see in the human dentition doesn't come about until about 4.4 million years ago, when we see a change in the size of the canine, the upper canine, especially. It goes from being a kind of a conical dagger-like canine to, this is your eye tooth in lay people's terms. It goes from being a dagger-like shape to something that's more diamond-shaped. So that changes very early, but the rest of our dentition, believe it or not, has not really changed that much from our ape ancestors. A human and chimpanzees and even baboons have the same number of teeth. And the morphology of humans and chimpanzees is very similar. We have less ridges, fewer ridges on our teeth. We have, you know, different relative sizes of our cusps. I mean, an expert could tell the difference, but a non-expert might get chimpanzee teeth, not the canines, but the molar teeth, let's say, confused with human teeth. Other big changes that come about are date to, let's say, maybe 1.9 million years ago, when we see Homo erectus, we start to see a reduction in the size of our wisdom teeth, with their third molar, the one farthest to the back. And that then what we see mostly is, in terms of human evolution from that point on, is dental reduction. So our teeth basically just get smaller, but the morphology doesn't really change that much.
Nice. Well, let's talk about some of the older stuff. So one of the reasons we've got you on the show today, because you were part of a recent article in Nature and also interviewed on Science Friday, both of which we'll link to in the show notes. What was the project that you were recently involved on? Can you first tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll talk about it.
All right. I've been involved in two projects recently. Those new weird human relatives from South Africa that have been called Homo naledi. And I'm still working on that. But in the news most recently was our collaborative work on the earliest Homo sapiens in Africa. So this was very big news because it pushed the date for Homo sapiens-like traits back to back about 100,000 years, so back to around 300,000 years, as opposed to the earliest Homo sapiens before this, coming from a place called Omo in East Africa and dating only to back 200,000 years. So that was big news. And it also, the reason why this was so interesting is because most of our fossil evidence for human evolution has come from East Africa and South Africa, with some bits and pieces here and there from Chad, which is more central. Mm-hmm. And these fossil remains from Jebel Yerhoud are from North Africa. We know of other fossils that are more recent from North Africa, but these going back 300,000 years and having modern human-like characteristics that are found only in Homo sapiens is really big news. So it shows that our evolution, the evolution of our species, was very likely something that was happening throughout Africa, rather than being linked to one specific place.
Mm-hmm. Which kind of makes sense if you think about it. I mean, evolution is such a, I guess, such a complex thing. And if the environment was, I guess, helping to trend species towards more specific traits all across the continent, maybe with, I don't know, some sort of changes in changes in the environment, whether it's weather or animals or other things like that, you know, helping to foster these evolutionary changes. I guess it would make sense that it would happen in more than one place, but maybe help out the listeners and us and talk a little bit about what makes something, I guess, what makes something Homo sapien from a 300,000-year-old perspective? Because, I mean, we have gone through some, I guess, some minor changes in that last 300,000 years, too, but we're still Homo sapiens. So what are scientists like yourself looking for when they say, okay, yeah, this species here at 400,000 years is not Homo sapien, but this species here is Homo sapien at 300,000 years? What are some of the big things you're looking for to make that determination? It might be a really complicated question.
Yeah. Well, no, it's a very good question. And in fact, what is it that makes us human? And by that, I'm speaking broadly in terms of Homo sapiens. Like, what is it that makes us human is a question that's been debated within our field for a long time, whether you're talking about culturally what makes us human. Is it, you know, is it language? Is it art? Or morphologically? The thing is that when you look at Homo sapiens around the world, we don't all look alike, right? So if we typically, what people think of, you know, people who are Europeans, who are, you know, think of as modern humans is, you know, they look at the people around them. And because, you know, it's mostly people in Europe, or the tradition has been that paleoanthropologists have been from Europe or America or something, you know, like that. And they're looking at people around them and saying, oh, well, we, you know, modern humans have very small or negligible brow ridges. We have a very prominent chin. We have big round heads with foreheads that are, you know, more bulbous or globular, you know, rather than sloping back. And a lot of the definition of Homo sapiens has been based on what we don't have rather than what we do have. So and often it's been contrasted with Neanderthals, because that was a huge paleoanthropological debate in the past, is were Neanderthals ancestors to modern humans or not? So we look at Neanderthals and we say, oh, well, we don't have this slopey, you know, forehead, and we don't have those big brow ridges, and, you know, we have a chin, but we don't have, you know, these primitive features. But when you, you know, when you look at people around the world, not all, everybody has a chin. And by that, I mean this, a prominence, you know, that sticks out. There's a skeletal definition to chin, which we don't need to go into, but it's not, you know, just that you have a lower jaw. It's that you have a aspect, a kind of jutting out part of the chin. And, you know, everybody has that, but besides a chin, identifiable chin or mental eminence, you know, there are people around the world, there are people in New York City, heck, you know, who walk by and you go, my God, look at those brow ridges, right? Or you see, you know, there are people who have foreheads that slope back, you know, and men have more slopey back foreheads than women do. So, you know, it's so, sorry to go, you know, into that so much, but it's hard to define what it is that makes us human. I attempted to do that dentally in a paper I co-authored with Jean-Jacques Hublin, who is also my co-author on this Jebel Irhoud paper, where I explored what it is that Homo sapiens has that that fossil hominins don't. And there weren't that many features. But there's a combination of features and that make us Homo sapiens that aren't found in other groups. And there are some features found in recent humans, or I should say that are absent in recent humans, that are only absent in recent humans. What defines us dentally is more what we lack rather than what we have. There are a few features like ridges on the lip side of your incisors, which are the teeth you see when you smile. This is called double shoveling. You only find this in Homo sapiens, but it's not present in all Homo sapiens. So that's another issue. When we talk about what it is that makes us human, we have to keep in mind that there are some traits that are only found in Homo sapiens, but that doesn't mean that all Homo sapiens have those traits. And this is what I found with the teeth, and this is what we found with skeletal material as well. With regard to Jebel Irhoud, what we have is a combination of features in which this skull has a lot of primitive features. That has a forehead that's kind of slopey, and the endocranium, the part of the neurocranium, neurocranium, which houses the brain, is primitive in its shape. But there are other aspects in the lower face, for example, that look very Homo sapiens-like, it's more vertical and it's reduced in size. And as far as the teeth go, we find a number of primitive characteristics that are also found in, let's say, Homo erectus. But there are no derived features, no unusual features or combination of features that are found in Neanderthals. So that was one of the first distinctions we made. Does it look like a Neanderthal or not? No, it doesn't look like a Neanderthal. One feature, so I'll try to explain it. So if you think about your lower molars, these are your chewing teeth. We know you have this white substance on our teeth that's called our tooth enamel. If you look underneath the tooth enamel, so what you can do is virtually take off the tooth enamel and look at the underlying surface, which is the dentine surface, which is more bone-like and less mineralized. The dentine surface of the Jebel Irhoud material is missing a feature that is present in Homo erectus and present in Neanderthals, but is only missing in Homo sapiens. It's a crest that connects the two most the two cusps that are closest to the front of the mouth, the most anterior cusp. So that's a middle trigonic crest. You see it in Neanderthals. You see it at the underlying surface of Homo erectus and, you know, most other fossil hominins, but it's only absent in Homo sapiens. So that's one of the dental features. Also, looking at the crown shape and looking what my colleagues have done is they've taken measurements and looking, again, this is the cool thing about this study is a lot of it wasn't even done in North Africa where the fossils remain. It was done virtually. So on my part, they made micro CT scans of the dentition and of the isolated teeth. They sent them, you know, to me. I uploaded them into a software program that allows me to look at the enamel surface. It allows me to take off the enamel and look at the underlying surface. And then there are ways to study the tooth shape that involves putting points, what we call landmarks, on the tips of the cusps and around the surface of the tooth. And when you look at that, Jebel Irhoud always falls either within Homo sapiens variation or between, let's say, some more primitive hominins and Homo sapiens. It doesn't ever fall with Homo erectus. It doesn't ever fall with Neanderthals. It doesn't fall with archaic Homo sapiens. So it's just somewhere in between there. That was very long-winded. Okay. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. That's great. It's really good detail. And we're going to go to break right now. But I will say, just to close out this segment, that we've all seen, I think, Neanderthal traits in a current Homo sapiens population when we go to family reunions. So
yes.
I'm just saying.
Behavioral or physical, yeah.
Exactly. All right, we're going to go to break, and we'll be back in just a second.
All these things we make no apology for the study of archaeology. But we don't do dinosaurs.
Did aliens build Stonehenge? Did the Easter Island statues walk? Did the Vikings colonize Midwest America? What does mainstream archaeology have to say about all of this? Listen to the Archaeological Fantasies podcast and learn about popular archaeological mysteries. Hoax or fact? Learn to tell the difference with Dr. Kenneth Fader and co-host Sarah of the Archie Fantasies blog. Check out the show on iTunes and Stitcher Radio and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Archie Fantasies and get ready to think critically. Let's get back to the show.
Funny beady blokes, you will see, are a staple of archaeology.
Okay, we're back. And so we were talking about, Shara, the 300,000-year-old fossils here. How are these dated besides, I know there's probably some relative dating you can look at with morphological changes and things like that, but how are these dated otherwise? How do we know they're 300,000 years old in this particular case?
I'll start with the original dating because it is somewhat relevant. So these fossils were found, the original fossils were found back in the late 1960s, and those were the ones I looked at back in 2004. But in 2004, they were able to reopen the site and start re-excavating. And at that time, they put in dosimeters into the background, we call it the matrix, the ground, basically, that was surrounding the site. And they do that in order to do a type of dating called thermoluminescence and another type of dating called electron spin resonance. And those dating techniques are based on the number of trapped electrons in fossil remains. So they date fossils directly. Often we have to date things like, for example, in East Africa, really old material is dated based on the ash, the volcanic ash in which it either where it's lying, or if it's in between ash layers, they can date the two layers and, you know, get something in between. Mm-hmm. But here they actually dated the fossils or the fauna, the animal fossils found with the originals. Now, back in 2007, my colleague Tanya Smith and other colleagues at the Max Planck published a paper on the Erhud material, specifically on the Erhud 3 jaw, which is the jaw of a juvenile, a young individual. And there was a chip of enamel broken off that they were able to use this kind of trapped electron dating technique on. And so they took out those dosimeters, which measure the radiation, the background radiation in the area, and they used those to then figure out how much radiation had accumulated in this tooth. So that tells you the time that jaw was laid down in that, you know, dirt or whatever. So at that time, we thought it was somewhere between 160 and 190,000 years ago. But remember that this was a 2004 excavation going back to where they thought they had found the stuff back in 1960. So fast forward, additional remains were found in situ, which means in the dirt. They were able to find a maxilla, the upper jaw, some isolated teeth, and they knew exactly where they were found. And so now they put in the dosimeters in the place that they know fossils are coming from. And then they use the accumulation rate from those and apply it to the new fossil human remains. And that's where we came up with a date of 300,000. So that, in fact, is much more accurate because it's based on where the fossils were actually found, not where we thought they were found back in the 1960s.
Okay. So let's broaden the picture a little bit more about where these were found then. Because just for our audience, in case they haven't read the article, were these found in a cave? Were they found in an open setting?
You know, Chris, I don't know. I haven't been to the site. They were found, I believe, through mining excavations, but I'm not sure if it was a cave. Or they do have faunal remains that are butchered, so it looks like it's a living site, you know, rather than some kind of just, oh, I fell off a cliff and here I am, dead.
Dragged in by a cheetah.
Yeah, I'd actually have to ask Jean-Jacques or reread the geological part of the article. So I don't know how to answer that question.
Yeah. You know, something else I was thinking about as I read the article, it was there was a question in there, and I think this was actually listed in the abstract too, if I'm not mistaken, so people can see that if they don't have access to the article, is there was a question of whether the modern Homo sapien morphology emerged rapidly over the last 200,000 years, or this is trying to answer that question, or I guess slowly over the last 400,000 years. And I guess my question to that is, does anything in evolution happen rapidly besides in smaller things? I know there's the common example of like the moths from England changing their color and things like that in a very short period of time. But those are, you know, small changes, individual things that make big changes. But when we're talking about an entire species evolving, yeah, does anything happen really quickly. Can we just not answer that question right away and say, no, probably not. It probably did happen slowly.
Yeah, I think I would say that evolution very rarely happens super quickly. It can mm-hmm. happen quickly if you have a major, as you suggested with the moth example, a major climatic or environmental change, and that could mean, so for example, the ancestor of bonobo chimpanzees and the common chimpanzees were separated by a geographical barrier, the Congo River, right? And probably then they may have evolved fairly rapidly after that because they couldn't exchange genes with one another, right, mm-hmm. anymore. So, but we actually have no fossil evidence we have like, I don't know, 5 teeth or something for chimpanzee evolution. So that's a hypothesis that would have to be tested. But no, it happens slowly. And the other cool thing that, you know, the Erhud material suggests is that because it's happening all over Africa, we can think of it in terms of like maybe the modern human neurocranium, the brain shape, you know, being very globular, maybe that evolved in East Africa, but maybe the chin evolved somewhere else, right? And so as long as these groups are exchanging genes, you know, then, okay, now the big brain or the bigger globular shape to the brain might be transferred up to North Africa over time or South Africa, because there's early Homo sapiens in South Africa as well. They're not as old as in East Africa, but there was certainly, you know, gene flow, genetic exchange going on between these peoples. And so mm-hmm. we can think of it as maybe not, I mean, it certainly could be happening everywhere at the same time because of similar environmental pressures. But I don't know if you've been to North Africa. It's a lot different from East Africa, which is quite different from South Africa, and probably was at that time, too. But it could be evolving more or less the same time because they're exchanging genes. So one human feature, dental feature, might show up in South Africa first, and through gene flow, it gets up to East Africa, and maybe it's maybe it has a selective advantage or maybe it doesn't. Sometimes the morphology we say, the changes we see, for example, Neanderthals, their suite of characteristics that makes a Neanderthal is probably just due to chance, right, due to isolation of those populations from others. So you've got that going on as well. So not every character we see is necessarily in response to the environment or through natural selection.
One of the things, when we think about human evolution, I think there's a couple of ways to kind of conceptualize it in the popular mind. One is sort of as this linear thing, like, okay, there's this primitive ancestor, then this one, then this one, then this one, and we move kind of from apes to the humans that we see today. And the next is as this tree, where there's sort of these dead-end branches where, oh, this trait didn't go anywhere, and we're sort of related by a common ancestor. But what it sounds like to me is that this is actually a lot more complicated picture, where you have multiple different kind of early hominids cohabitating, sharing DNA. They're different groups. I know that there's been a lot of evidence that multiple kind of species, but different groups of early hominids are on the same types of landscapes, and that this is a much more complicated evolutionary process than most people really are thinking about.
It absolutely is, April. And one of the things that complicates it too, and people haven't really looked into this that much because I think it's a difficult question to, or hypothesis to test, is the fact that not only were there, you know, different populations of the same species, but there were different species of humans living at the same time. And a colleague of mine has shown that in mammals, this is Trent Holliday's work, more than a decade ago in the journal Current Anthropology. In mammals, species that have been separated for less than a million years can mate and produce offspring. So a lot of these hominins could be, even if they're different species, they could mate and produce offspring, and then that's, you know, going to mess up the whole picture because they're going to have characteristics of both, right? Or something new, because sometimes when you the two species are distinct, have separated. Neanderthals and modern humans have been separate for, let's say, 700 to 900,000 years. When two different species mate, even if they can produce offspring, sometimes the offspring have funky things going on, like an extra canine or a fourth molar or some, you know, some weird things mm-hmm. too.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And another thing along with evolution too that I tried to, I mean, my limited knowledge, I try to explain to people is it's not always, and you kind of alluded to this, Shara, but it's not always advantageous traits that propagate throughout a system. And it could just be a trait that somebody has that happens to be relatively dominant, or let's say it's a male of the species that has this trait, and they're just very sexually prolific, and they just get their traits, whether they're advantageous or not, into a whole bunch of different people, and then, you know, that starts to make its way through the population. It doesn't have to be an advantage, a sexual or environmental advantage, you know, to be. It just has to not be a detriment to basically producing offspring.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. It has to not be a detriment. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily have to produce an advantage. And the other thing is it can produce an advantage that is so small we can't even really grasp it. But, you know, like mm-hmm. maybe if you can live an extra 2-3 years, maybe, or if you mature, let's say a year earlier than the next person, you might right. leave one extra offspring. Well, that's an advantage, right? That's very small advantage in terms of reproduction can ultimately lead to one species, taking over another, or you know, pushing the other one to extinction. So, that's a really good point that you bring up. And there's a lot of common misperceptions about human evolution, and you've touched on quite a number of them.
All right. Well, we've got a bunch more questions, and we're gonna have the third segment coming up. But so we don't have to stop right in the middle of something, I think we'll take our last break now, and then we'll have a slightly longer third segment. So we'll be back in just a second. Women in Archaeology is a show about archaeology by the Women of Archaeology. An alternating panel of women archaeologists discuss the issues in archaeology that impact professionals and the public every day. Check out Women in Archaeology for a different perspective on the past today at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/WIA. Now let's get back to the show.
All right, well, welcome back to the Archaeology Show. And today we are talking with Shara Bailey. And one of the things that we've mentioned a couple of times is your research on Homo naledi. Could you just tell us a little bit more about who Homo naledi is and how does this relate to the new find that we've also been talking about, this 300,000-year-old find?
Sure, I'm happy to talk a little bit about Homo naledi. So Homo naledi is a name given to human remains that were found in South Africa. How many years ago is it now? Maybe it's 3 years ago. I think it was 2014 and published in 2015. So, what makes them unusual is a number of things. First, the way they were found. Lee Berger, who is the, kind of guy in charge, he's, down at the University of Witwatersrand. He, on a hunch thinking, you know, there's gotta be more fossil hominins out there in these interesting South African caves. And when I say caves, you need to not imagine caves of, typical caves that you walk in from the outside, but caves that are created in limestone that are really underneath the ground, right? So mm-hmm. cave systems. So he hired people who do this for a living, spelunkers. And lo and behold, not that long after that, they, you know, came back with a piece of bone or took a picture of a piece of bone and said, you know, what is this, a hominin? And yes, it was. So he put together an excavation an excavation team to go in and start pulling out the hominin bones and figuring out what they are. Now, to get into the Dinaledi chamber, this site is outside of Johannesburg in South Africa. To get into the Dinaledi chamber, you have to go in about a quarter of a mile, which requires going into what they call the dark zone, right? So there's no light, it's pitch dark, unless you have a light with you. It requires going through several small sections. One is called the post box because of how small it is. Another is called the Superman's crawl because you literally have to get on your stomach and then put your hands out in front of you and use your fingers and pushing off with your toes to get through it on your stomach. Then that gets you into a chamber that you then have to go up something called the dragon's back to go get to a chute that is at its narrowest about 11 inches. I'll pause there for dramatic effect. And you have to go down this fairly long chute that gets quite tight. And then at the bottom of that chute is Dinaletti Chamber. And then they got in there and there are just bones everywhere. So when they did a month of excavation, I believe they pulled out 1,200 fossil bones. And we've been then, I wasn't on the original team that was put together by Berger. I was brought in last year, because I'm a specialist in the dentition, and especially right now I've been spending a lot of time studying baby teeth, and they didn't, have an expert on that. So I got brought into the team last year to study the baby teeth. So not only are the circumstances so unusual because A, how did they get in there? B, why did they get in there? And C, you know, why didn't they come out? if people are putting them there intentionally, why wouldn't you just stop at the first chamber or stop at the Superman crawl? Like, why are you going to drag a dead body this anyway? But then you look at the morphology and their brains are small. 600 cubic centimeters is the largest. Some are smaller. The postcrania, the below the head, the bones below the head have some really primitive, like 3.8 million year old primitive features from Australopithecines, and then they have some derived features that look like Homo, our genus. And the teeth also show a similar mosaic, you know, a collection of features in that the lower canines, your eye teeth again, look very primitive. They look like Australopithecines. They are pointy. They have a high cusp. They have a little extra distal cusp, little tubercle on it. Looks very primitive. The upper teeth, the upper molars look, they look kind of like Homo. They're kind of simple. They don't have a lot of the extra bumps and grooves that you see in really older hominins. The deciduous teeth, the baby teeth that I've been looking at, show a similar pattern and in fact, in some ways resemble these an evolutionary sidelined branch, the paranthropines, in that they have like extra cusps and ridges on them that you only see in these very robust hominins. Again, they're a side branch. They didn't have anything to do with our human evolution, but they have these massively large teeth with all sorts of extra bumps and grooves on them. The Naledi teeth are small, like the genus Homo. But some of the teeth, some of the deciduous teeth have characteristics that link them with Australopithecines on one hand, the paranthropines, the side branch on another, and Homo. So that's just a very, it's kind of like evolution says, ha, that's not what you think. You think you have it figured out, try this, you know. And then they've just been finally, the dates on them have been released. And they're like 300,000 years old. They're about the same age as the Jebel Irhoud Homo sapiens. So what that means is that at the same time you have Homo sapiens on the on the coast in the interior, at least of South Africa, you've got something that was spending a lot of time in trees, very primitive in a lot of aspects, but also has some modern-like features.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anything you would ever predict. I mean, it's so unusual that, you know, Lee Berger, who's, you know, been running it, has said even to me, and I think he's been quoted as saying too, is that this suggests that if you find just a part of a skeleton, you cannot make any prediction about what the rest is going to look like. And I think that might be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. But you know, he has a point, because we would never have predicted this.
Yeah. Well, and isn't it true that, I don't want to say a lot, but some of our ancestors, I guess, or relatives in the hominid family tree are based on like a single fossil, like a single, you know, small piece of a larger organism. And then, but it was different enough. We're like, oh, this is a different species, because, you know, paleoanthropologists like to be splitters sometimes make a new branch. Yeah.
Right. I think for all the species we retain, or the, you know, the ones most of us accept, there's more than, you know, a couple bits and pieces, but you know, Homo heidelbergensis was named for a lower jaw found in Heidelberg, Germany. And we have no idea what Homo heidelbergensis' skull is supposed to look like.
Right.
Right. And so we have fossils that we stick into Homo heidelbergensis, but that's another big, you know, debate within paleoanthropology, is what to do with that material. Mm-hmm. Because the taxon, you know, was named after something that we only have a jaw of. So, yeah.
Right. And real quick, regarding the cave, that the Dinaleti cave, did I not hear something about, and maybe you know or don't know about this, but did I not hear that there, some people are theorizing that the way that the scientists got in there was not possibly the way that those organisms got in there, that maybe there was another entrance or something like that? Because didn't it go down? It didn't go, like, you know, straight down all this way. It went kind of linearly a little bit. So there could have been another entrance as limestone, you know, fills in and then it dissolves away and then fills in again and dissolves away. There could have been another entrance. Is that still kind of the common thinking or not?
Well, I brought that up myself when I was out on the site last year. What I was told was that they've had geologists in there and that nobody can find another entrance. Also the geology out there, it's all dolomitic stuff, which is very, very, very old. Right. And so it's not been, you know what I mean? Like, if there was another entrance, at the surface, we would, I guess they're saying we would, it would still be there today.
Okay.
And, And the other thing is that regardless of whether there's another entrance, only hominins, only human relatives, because I don't personally think these guys had anything to do with our evolution. Only hominid bones were found in this cave. So if there was another entrance, you would expect other animals to fall into the cave.
Yeah.
Right. Or to be brought into the cave by carnivores. Right. Or something. Because like the site of Cima de los Huesos in Spain, which also you have to traverse a lot of cave to get to. They have cave bear bones. They have fox bones, and that suggests that there was another entrance, you know, to get into the cave, because animals got in there. At Dinaleti Cave, I think there's one owl bone and like a couple, like two or three mouse bones or something like that. Jeez. I mean, it's remarkable how few animal bones there are in there, and there's no artifacts in there either.
Yeah.
And animals don't do that.
Right. Well, and you think if they were dragged in by some kind of animal over, you know, that was its like den or something to drag early humans into, that there would be fossils littered almost throughout the entrance, because, you know, I mean, maybe they would have fallen apart or something.
Yes.
Stop and have a snack, you know, who knows? Now, you mentioned the numbers of fossils in there, but do they have a count on the number of individuals represented yet?
They do, and I'm drawing a blank, but I think it's between 10 and 20.
Because that sounds like a pretty small number, and I'm just wondering if maybe there was some horrific environmental event going on outside, and this band of people just said, well, let's go as far as we can because, you know, there's some kind of volcano erupting or something. Is there any geology to support that, do you know, or is that just a wild theory?
I think any theory that anybody comes up with at this point is just as implausible as as personally as them dragging dead bodies through there.
Right.
As you said, you would think that they would come apart. I mean, you know, dead bodies go, if you don't bury them right away, they go through rigor mortis, right? And you cannot pull a stiff body through.
Yeah.
And also, they're the only people that could get in there were these seven petite archaeologists, all women, because it's so small. So, you know, you'd have to have, it seems extremely implausible, but you know, and your hypothesis is equally implausible. I've speculated that, I've speculated that it was perhaps some type of genocide. You know, maybe Homo sapiens were killing everybody, and they said, well, let's just follow this cave and see if we can get out some other way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then once they went down that chute, I don't know, perhaps they couldn't get back out and they just died there. But you know, I've thrown that out there. My students are like, well, why wouldn't they climb back out? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I don't know. You know, so but there's only three. They haven't taken all the, there's lots and lots of bones still there. And they're not going to take everything out because they want to leave it for the future for people to, you know, to be able to use new techniques to investigate new hypotheses. But so far, you know, most of the individuals are adults. We have, so I was studying the baby teeth, and there's one individual that's represented by almost all his teeth or her teeth, we don't know. And then there's like two other individuals represented just by single teeth, but we know they're different individuals because the duplicate, you know, the teeth we already have.
Right.
So there's three kids and, you know, and many more adults. And I don't know if that's significant or not, because of course they don't have all of it excavated, but the big question is how they got in there and why they got in there. I think it's anybody's guess.
Sounds like aliens to me, Shara. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, okay. Except aliens.
All right. Sorry. Go ahead, April.
No, you're fine. So people suggested ideas of kind of social complexity. I know that's one of the kind of questions that people are looking into, is how complex were the social organization of these early hominids and, you know, their tool use and evidence, you know, music, instruments, art. So that was one of the things I kind of thought about when you're talking about this. It's like, oh, this is really interesting. There's a reason, maybe it's a social reason, just, you know, how you know you're an anthropologist. People think that there's higher levels of social organization in some of these early hominid groups?
Well, you know, if the Homo naledi people were burying their dead, which is what the, you know, the original team, I guess that's their hypothesis, which is fine. I don't agree with it, but, you know, I don't have the answer. If they're burying their dead, then they've suggested that would be indicative of some kind of symbolic behavior. I would say, yeah, sometimes you bury the dead because they smell bad. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, and there's no grave goods or anything found with it, right? There's no stone tools, no offerings and things. Really, it's not until you get to Neanderthals where you have some inklings of symbolic thought. But you could really count on one, maybe two hands. So we're talking between 5 and 10 instances throughout the entire 200,000 years that Neanderthals are around, and all the sites, and there's lots and lots of Neanderthal sites. There's let's say less than 10 incidences of Neanderthals making art or any suggestion of art. So there's something that looks like it could be a flute, you know, with a juvenile bear bone from Slovenia. There's a piece of rock that has a bone stuck through it that somebody thinks looks like a mask. There's a very nice Acheulean hand axe that has a beautifully preserved fossil shell in the middle that suggests that the maker had some kind of appreciation you know, aesthetic appreciation of this fossil shell that they intentionally put very, you know, symmetrically in the middle of this hand axe. And there's the possible use of feathers and ochre. But again, if you compare that to what you see with the emergence of Homo sapiens in Europe 50,000 years ago, all of a sudden it's like, oh, they're painting their caves, they're making beautiful art, they're doing all these things. So there's something to me qualitatively different between those groups that has to do with symbolic activity. And that may or may not have something to do with whether or not Neanderthals had a complex language. I certainly think they could verbalize and make a lot of modern human-like sounds, although not all of the sounds, but I'm not convinced that they could think symbolically or in terms of past, present, and future and articulate that, you know, verbally.
Well, I think something we tend to forget, especially because of, you know, museums and shows on National Geographic and things like that, is you know, we typically portray those like Neanderthals and other, you know, relatives like that of the Homo sapien line. We typically portray them using stone and bone and painting on cave walls and doing things like that because those are the things that preserve in the fossil record. There's so many other things, as you well know, that just simply don't preserve that they could have been using that were part of their, you know, part of their toolkit or part of their, even part of their ritual or part of their living. And it just doesn't preserve and never will preserve.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where things like feathers and ochre and talons, you know, come in. And people have done really interesting studies, you know, to see if mm-hmm. they're overrepresented, you know, there's more of them in the fossil record than you would expect, you know, just by yeah. chance. And we certainly know that people 300,000 years ago were using wooden spears, right?
Right.
They have preserved, but in most cases, things that aren't stone are not going to preserve. So you're at, yeah. that's a very good point. Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're just about out of time. I just wanted to ask you one last question, and I think I saw something related to this in the article. Is the question of where Homo sapiens, you know, modern Homo sapiens emerged in Africa, is that the big question in paleoanthropology right now, would you say? If there were one question that everybody was really kind of interested in, is where did the first human happen, you know? And do we still think that that's even answerable? Is it one place, or is it this trait emerged here and this trait emerged here and they all kind of came together at some point? But I guess you're looking for that point would be the first human. So is that a big yeah. question in anthropology everybody's trying to answer? And if not, what is?
I think I'd have to say that the biggest questions in paleoanthropology are the first of anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So people are looking for the earliest hominin, and that's,
right.
you know, and that's been pushed back. And is highly debated. And so, you know, the first Homo sapiens, yes. And the thing is that the DNA, the mitochondrial DNA pinpoints it, you know, to one matril line, right, a maternal lineage in East Africa. But you know, the morphology, what we're thinking of as being modern human in terms of the skeleton might not map onto that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So you could be genetically, maybe the modern human mitochondrial DNA lineage, it goes back to East Africa, maybe, you know, but maybe the morphology doesn't change until later, or maybe the morphology changed first. Right. So I think thinking it in terms of a Pan-African event is a big change. I'm not sure that we were, you know, specifically looking for that, you know, to like, let's pinpoint. Or let's decide whether it's one place or multiple places. But yeah, I guess I would say where that transition occurred is mm-hmm. one of the bigger questions in paleoanthropology. And now, instead of asking where did that occur, we need to go back and say where else did it occur and when. I mean, there's some earlier fossils that might actually be very similar to Homo sapiens as well in Ndutu, I think that's in East Africa. I'm not sure. Anyway.
Well, I'm sure, and less, I guess, less sexy because it's not Homo sapien, but people are probably trying to figure out, okay, so we got Australopithecus, you know, afarensis. Where's the first example of, you know, of that? I mean, they were around for, you know, a million plus years. So, or
yeah,
Homo erectus or things like that, you know?
absolutely. Earliest Homo. That's a big one.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Because, oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's a huge one. There's huge debates. And, you know, and which early Homo is, you know, on our Homo sapiens lineage and which are side branches.
Right.
There's so many things we can argue about. it's all big questions.
Nice.
That's the reality.
Okay. Well, I think that gives us all a lot to think about, and I'm glad to bring in some paleoanthropology into the archaeology show. I was just talking to somebody the other day. I want to have, might have to change the name of this network because I want to, paleoanthropology was always kind of my, before I got into archaeology, was my real passion. And then ASU rejected my graduate school application and I dropped it and went into cultural resource management. But I even went to East Africa. I did an excavation at Olduvai Gorge with Earthwatch. So, yeah, it was really fun. But anyway, eventually we will have a paleoanthropology podcast and we'll have you back on that to get deeper into some of these topics. So
That'd be great.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Shara. And again, if I hope to have you on again if we have any more exciting finds to talk about so we can let people know about them.
Well, I appreciate you having me on the show. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.